Good morning, everybody. I've been coming to the chapel now for about 4 years, and I've gotten to know a few of you, many of you, but certainly not all. And to many of you, I'm an unknown quantity. You don't know me, so I'm going to give you a bit of my personal testimony before I go into what message I have here. I grew up not far from here, down in Havertown. And my parents, good parents, I had a great home. They were Catholic, and I was Catholic. I was an altar boy. Took it very seriously, actually. And, you know, I love God. I didn't initially have any concept of that, the grace of God. But, you know, I think God was looking out for me then, and I know he was doing things in my life to bring me to him. Both my parents grew up living very close to the earth. They were from Vermont, and Vermont is a place where, I don't know, it's just sort of, it's a little different up there. They're not as attuned to the modern day things of the world. And they grew up, you know, in the 30s. And in fact, I have kind of an old family. All of my grandparents were born in the 1880s. So I go, you know, my family was kind of older. My parents were born in, you know, right around 1920, and then they grew up in the 30s in the Depression, and they didn't have much. And, you know, my father, when he was a kid, they did things that, you know, we wouldn't think of today. They had very little to play with. There was no TV. I don't even know if they really had radio. I guess they probably did. But they would do things like just go out into the woods and just play all day, you know. It's funny, if you see their houses, I go up there still, and their houses are big, but the rooms are tiny. There's not much room for doing anything. You know, they didn't have a computer or a television, or they didn't even really have that many clothes. If you go into the closets are like this big. And they didn't have any clothes. And so he would do things like they would go out into the woods, they would build dams, they would climb trees. In fact, one of the things that he loved to do when he was a kid, he would always tell me about it, and he tried to teach me to do it, but I never got really good at it. They would spring birch trees. You go to the edge of the forest where the birches are, and they're thin and spindly, and you make your way up. You have to shimmy up there. You have to find just the right one. It's kind of hard to do. But you get up there, and you start rocking the tree back and forth like this. And then if you're good, you know, you get it to just the right spot where you go, and the tree will take you down to the ground. And you let go at just the right time, and if you don't break anything, it's a really fun thing to do. When my father was in high school sports, they didn't have a gym like you do today. I mean, they had the gym, you know, but they didn't have the weight room and all the, you know, the equipment. They would do things, I mean, it was kind of crazy, but they would go up this hill. There was a lonely pine out in, you know, behind his house. And that was their workout. They would run up the hill, climb the pine tree, get to the top, come back down, and come back, you know. So that's how they worked out. That's how they got in shape. They did things like that. So I grew up with a guy that, when I was young, thought I should be climbing trees. It was just what you did. And here I am in suburban Philadelphia, and I did. I climbed trees in my neighborhood. My dad would get phone calls, you know, get your kid out of my tree. But I thought it was fun, and my brothers did too. We had tree houses, we had rope swings. It was just part of life for me, you know, and a good part of life too. And I'm very happy that was the case for me. My mom was also, she grew up on a farm, and when she was a little girl, she used to tell me, like, she would have to get up before dark and run and go up this hill. In fact, I have a picture of the hill in the slideshow that I'm going to show. She would have to get the cows from the far end of the field where they like to hang out at night, bring them all the way over and down to the barn so that for milking they would be there every morning, you know, and you can't miss that, you know. I still can't, you know, I guess people do it all the time, but it's just a little beyond me. So anyway, I just want to get back to the Catholicism thing. You know, Catholicism is a really complicated issue for me. I used to start my testimony by saying that when I was 21, a friend of mine brought me to Tyler Arboretum good friend. And because he knew I liked the woods. I liked being outside. And we used to, this was a party friend of mine. We used to go downtown and, you know, carousing and whatnot. And so one night he said, "Chuck, look, how about this, man? Let's skip it. Let's not go down to Smokey Joe's. Let's go out to Tyler." And he knew I loved to do that. So we get there, and he's got a flashlight and a Bible. And I still remember he started going through all these passages in 2 Timothy. And, you know, he was talking about the end times, and we were talking about some other things too. And it was then that I really feel like I knew this was something different, you know, that salvation isn't really something we accomplish. It's not our work that does it. It's God's work. And we just say thank you, basically. It was funny. I remember still having such a hard time thinking, you know, I had been an altar boy for so long. You know, I was a pretty good one, too. I mean, I did the 6 o'clock masses during the week, which meant I got up early and went to do the masses. And I did, you know, the Sunday ones. And to think that all that is worth nothing, it was really hard for me. That was a really tough thing to get over. Like, you mean all that I did is nothing, just worthless? And yeah, it was. But the good news is you get so much more for free. I mean, it was just God's grace is so much greater than that. And you could never earn your way to heaven. And it was really freeing for me. You know, it took a few weeks, you know, before that really sunk in. But I'd just like to say that my testimony now backs up a little bit to when I was Catholic. Because every week or every day, if I was saying, you know, hearing Mass, doing it during the week, I heard the gospel. You know, you get a reading from Paul, you get a reading from, or, you know, sometimes another letter, but, and you get a reading from the gospel. And like, over a 20-year period, that sunk in. There was something there that God was telling me. And so I thank that. I also had, there was this one priest named Father Falls, and he would give a talk every Sunday at 10:15. It was the children's mass. And, you know, I still remember those. He was so Christ-centered. I look back on some of those talks, and, like, they were great. And I think I'm going to see this guy again. He's long gone from this earth, but I think I'm going to see Father Falls again. I really do, and I can't wait to see him. You know, when I was, like, 12 or 13, I don't know where this came from, but I asked my dad for a Bible for Christmas. So I think God was doing something in me back then, even, and there was something stirring. And I remember my father telling me, you know, we just don't do that. Bibles, you know, we had a big red one in the living room, and it had gold around the outside, but you never opened the thing. It was just there. And so, you know, to buy a Bible. Now, the Catholics were just starting then to get Bibles. There was something called the Way, where you could kind of read the Bible on your own. But my dad was old school, and he just said, no, forget it. You know, you're going to get a bike or whatever. So, but I'd like to say, I still know many Catholics. I work with a lot of Catholic women. And, you know, I think it's really cool. That's changed a lot. The Catholics read the Bible now. And they have, my mother, before she passed away 4 years ago, went to a Bible study every week at the Catholic Church. So I'd just like to say that I think God's moving in that arena, and things are changing there for the better, very much for the better. So, anyway, when I was 21, I my friend took me out to Tyler, and it wasn't just that. I just also want to say that Gary's wife, Kim, was kind of important to me back then, too. She was the first one that I didn't know personally who shared her faith with me. And kind of helped lead me to the Lord. I was hoping she'd going to be here today, but I guess she couldn't make it because of work. When I became a believer, things moved kind of fast. My college career was kind of crazy. I dropped out because I didn't know what I wanted to do, you know. And then I went to work, and I didn't like work either, so I went back to school. So then I dropped out again, and I took 7 years to get through. I always say I crammed 4 years into seven. It took 7 years, but I finally got a degree in forestry. But anyway, at this point, I was about to go up to Penn State. I had gotten in again, and we went up there, and I went with my friend Bob, who had shared, you know, with me at Tyler. And we get there, and like, we needed a place to stay. I was a little late. I couldn't get in the dorms for some reason. And so the Campus Crusade for Christ had a house there. They had this beautiful, like, it was on Fraternity Row. Nice big house. And they needed people to live there. So I thought, well, I need a place to live, and these guys seem like nice guys. And I hadn't even been to one of their Bible studies or anything. I didn't know anything about this ministry. But, well, I figured, okay, I'll move in. And that was a pretty wild chapter. I was able to function, and I think pretty well, within that, I don't know what you call it, but it's, you know, Bill Bright did a great thing. It's a great ministry. He saved a lot of people, and a lot of college kids really have come to know the Lord through that ministry. But it wasn't me. Okay, I remember going to Beaver Stadium before games and handing out tracts and thinking, you know, I didn't have the depth, the knowledge that God, you know, needs to work into somebody's heart, I think, to really evangelize. You know, I would get into these discussions and I'd feel like I lost the debate half the time. I just couldn't, I didn't know anything, you know. I kind of knew the Bible, but not really. So I went through about a year of that. And then the second year, they lost the house for some reason. I forget what that was. And then I kind of left Campus Crusade for Christ. And I went to another group that was sort of an offshoot of Navigators that fit me much better. It was a little more nourishing. It wasn't so much get out there and, you know, share the four spiritual laws. So, and I'm really grateful for that, because from that moment on, I felt like I was really growing. But I do remember reading things. I remember Josh McDowell very well. His books were, you know, very good. And Hal Lindsey was important back then for some reason. All the end time stuff was big deal. I don't know what happened to that. But it's, anyway, I just remembered that. As I was writing this out, I thought, well, I wonder what happened to him, you know. But, I also just like to say, Penn State was just an awesome place to go to school. Spiritually, it's just such a wonderful environment. I mean, there's like every flavor of Christian up there, and they're all on fire. It's really an awesome place. But you know, my college career thankfully ended. Finally, I got a degree and I came home, and that's when I got to know Kim a little better. And Kim brought Bob and me down to a place called Philadelphia Christian Fellowship, which was sort of a brethren-ish type of church. It was smaller than this one. There weren't that many people. But there was really good teaching there. I remember a number of the guys there, just like here. They were just very, very good, and I enjoyed it. I remember reading Watchman Nee, which was, again, kind of popular back then. He's not so popular now, but he was really good. C.H. McIntosh, who I'm going to get back to in a little while. He was my favorite. I hit him, and it was just like, wow. I still am amazed by the guy. I love reading C.H. McIntosh. Also Francis Schaeffer. And a few weeks ago when Rick gave his talk, I thought it was kind of funny. He showed a picture of the 5-volume set that Schaeffer put out. And in 1986, I remember, I bought that 5-volume set. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to read this. Because all the people at Philadelphia Christian Fellowship were talking about it. They all read it. All the guys teaching read it. And I thought, I'm going to read this. I couldn't read that to save my life. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was just going right over my head. I don't know. But I would try to read it. I couldn't read it. I went on a backpacking trip, I remember. I just went by myself one time. I just took like 10 days or so. And I went up to the Adirondacks, to the High Peak region. And I thought, all I'm going to bring with me to read are going to be 2 volumes of Francis Schaeffer. So I'm going to have to read it, because you're up there for a long time. And you get reined in some days, you know. It's just going to be me and Francis Schaeffer. I'm going to read this stuff. I don't think I read 3 pages of that book. It just still didn't hit me, you know. And in fact, if anybody wants a 5-volume set of Francis Schaeffer, I think I still have it up in the attic. One thing I remember, though, there's one of the talkers there at Philadelphia Christian Fellowship said something that just stuck with me, and it's always been around. I'm sure you've all heard it. The Westminster what are they, the Confessions of Faith or the Articles of Faith or something. But there's one in the shorter catechism, you know, what is the chief end of man? And I just think this is so cool. He says, man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Amen. And man, that just sings to me. I just think, you know, God is so good. And we just need to remember that and just rest in him and enjoy him, you know? And it's something, ever since then, that's kind of been, I call it, I'm an old Trekkie, and I call it my prime directive, you know? I need to glorify God. I need to enjoy him, you know? And in today's world, that's kind of hard to do. It really is, because this world wants us to do everything but enjoy God. And this world wants us to be engaged in so much stuff that is just has nothing to do with God. And anyway, I just want to throw that out there. And after a while, I'm not sure what happened, but things at Philadelphia Christian Fellowship changed. People came and went. It was a small group. They kind of lost the critical mass to keep going. And I don't think they're even fellowshipping down there anymore. But I kind of left there, and I went to Church of the Savior for a while. Actually, quite a few years. Which was a good place to be, but I kind of got lost in there. You know, I don't know. Again, it's a great ministry. It's a great church. It wasn't me. I kind of always felt like, you know, I'm just sort of visiting here. And even though I was there for like 5 years. And in fact, they had a lot of turmoil over there at some point, and I don't know, I just got kind of turned off by it. And then I ended up going to Christ Community Church for a while. There again, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years, something like that. And I felt a little more a part of things there, but it still wasn't really me. And time went on, and here I guess we're up to about 12 years ago now, maybe 13, 14 years, around 2000. At some point, I just stopped going to church. I don't know why. I have a job. I'm a nurse. And at the time, I was doing a lot of weekends. I worked for an agency that kind of puts you in places when they need you. You know, you fill in the gaps, and often the gaps are on weekends, so I work weekends, and, you know, that was part of it. But that wasn't the whole thing. I don't know what it was. I don't know why I stopped fellowshipping. I knew it was wrong. And I'll tell you, another thing that's kind of odd is that and this is not good either, but I didn't really spend much time in the Word. I don't know why. I think of this as being like a dark time for me, although I didn't feel like it was a dark time, but it's not good to be separated. And I'm thankful that I didn't end up doing something, you know, going the wrong way or something. I did pray a lot, though. I still had, I think my relationship with God was very much intact. It just, for some reason, I lost those contacts. And I've never really been a big student of the Bible, even now. It's not my strong suit. So anyway, I'd like to kind of go back to C.H. McIntosh, because even in those times, like, well, and even today, when I have those dark moments or those tough days, I like to go to C.H. McIntosh. I read the Bible, but for some reason, you know, I tend to take things very literally. My father always made fun of the kids because we were half Polish. I hope there's no Polish people in here, but Polish people, I think, tend to take things very literally. My mother did, and so did my brothers and sisters, and I think it's endearing. I think it's kind of cute, really, but stuff just goes right over my head. When I read poetry, I don't get any of it. Nothing. I mean, I'm hearing about the birds and the trees, and I'm looking out the window to see what's going on. I don't know what they're talking about. I know everything refers to something and means something, but I don't know what it is. And when I read the Bible, sometimes I feel like there's this code there that everybody else has except me. I don't know what it is. So if it says it plainly, I get it. Otherwise, I can't put all the pieces together. And this is what I like about Francis Schaeffer, is that he gets it all. He doesn't just read the book, but he pulls the other things in, and he can synthesize everything and tell you what's going on. Not only what's said, but what wasn't said, which is often very important, just as important as what is said. So I'm going to... This is my McIntosh book. I love McIntosh. If I ever get a dog, I'm going to name him McIntosh. I, I've got three readings. They're pretty short. He's tough to read. He died, I think, in around 1890, and he was Irish. And he has a way of writing. It's really kind of enjoyable when you get into it, but it's hard to. You kind of have to go line by line sometimes and think so. Anyway, I practiced this last night, but bear with me here. We'll get through it. The one that I'm going to read, the one story, and it was cool to hear Andy, you know, I think the Holy Spirit was speaking through you a little bit there, talking about David. David's just such an awesome character. And there's a 90-page book about him in here. David's life was so cool. It's just such an awesome life. Everything about the guy was just incredible. I mean, he had his highs and his lows, and the story is just amazing. I mean, you know, Hollywood can't make anything this good. It really can't. David was just so awesome. And the part that I'm going to read about is mostly about, you know, David and Goliath, and then Jonathan too, a little bit. So this is before David meets Goliath on the. Well, they're all, you know, Goliath is taunting them, and David comes on the scene because you know nobody's been able to deal with Goliath. So somehow David gets there, and McIntosh says. But the Lord was secretly preparing an instrument for this new and more difficult work. And may we not say, it is ever thus that the blessed God acts. He trains in secret those whom he is about to use in public. He makes his servants acquainted with himself in the secret solemnity of his sanctuary, and causes his greatness to pass in review before them, that thus they may be able to look with a steady gaze at the difficulties of their path. Thus it was with David. He had been alone with God while keeping the sheep in the wilderness. His soul had become filled with the thought of God's power. And now he makes his appearance in the valley of Elah in all the simplicity and self-renouncing dignity of a man of faith. The emptiness of man had been fully proved by 40 days of Goliath's haughty boasting. Saul could avail nothing. Jesse's three eldest sons could avail nothing. Yea, even Jonathan could avail nothing. All was lost, or seemed to be, when the stripling David entered the scene, clothed in the strength of him who was about to lay in the dust the pomp and glory of the proud Philistine. I just think it's so cool how I didn't realize the beginning of that, like how David spent all those years. He wasn't just a shepherd. God was working in him in those years. God was the only one with him. You know, he's out there guarding these sheep, which is kind of not a big deal job. I mean, his brothers were in the army. They were commanders. They had the big jobs. David's just watching these sheep, but he's totally exposed to the elements all this time, years. Not just the cold, the wind, and the rain and all that, but lions and bears. And, you know, God, through those years, I mean, David had actually killed a lion and a bear. God, like, kind of wrung out the fear of David. David grew in strength, courage, and confidence. When he got to that place, he wasn't just a man of faith. I mean, when I heard this story when I was younger, you think, okay, he's just a guy who came in and said, you know, I can do anything with God. You know, go and I will be with you. You know, it was more than that. God had worked in him to make this confident being that stood before Saul and said, I can deal with this. This is no problem. I've killed a lion, I've killed a bear, and I'm going to kill this guy. And I think that one of the lessons to be learned here, to me, is that David grew up outside of the structure of the day. He never went to boot camp or gladiator school or whatever else all these guys that were standing there listening to Goliath taunt them. He didn't do any of that stuff. He probably didn't even go to school. But he spent time alone with God in the wilderness. And when he got to this valley, when he got to this place, he was more capable than anybody to deal with this guy. And it wasn't even hard for him. It really wasn't. This was nothing for him because of the work that God had done in him. So sometimes I think of the world and the structure that we have. I'm not a structure guy. I hate structure. That's why I didn't like school. That's why I don't like work. I do it because I have to. But, you know, I am more of a free spirit, and that's why I love being out in the woods, and if I ever get a chance, I take the kayak and my backpack, and that's where I am. I think God does a work in those times, and I think that the world we live in does not appreciate that at all. and doesn't want us to do that. We're in this world, so we're affected by that. We're not of the world, though. And I'd like to say, I know that there's a lot of people. I see kayaks on roofs in the parking lot, and I know people go hiking. And I know a lot of people in this fellowship actually take the time to get out there and do this. But just want to throw that out. That's my feeling about structure and school and all that stuff. So fast forward a little bit, and then you get to the point where David's going to go out and, you know, McIntosh, I just love the way he says this stuff. He says, "And David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed to go, for he had not proved it. And David said unto Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David put them off." McIntosh says, "Happy deliverance from the trammels of human policy. It has been observed, and most truly so, that David's trial was not when he met the giant in actual conflict, but when he was tempted to use Saul's armor. Had the enemy succeeded in inducing him to go with that, all was gone. But through grace, he rejected it, and thus left himself entirely in the Lord's hands. And we know what security he found there. This is faith. It leaves itself in God's hand." And there's a little footnote here, too. It says, "Faith, waiting on God, allows him to use what means soever he pleases. It does not ask him to bless our means, but lets him use his own." And then, of course, right, you know what happens with Goliath. And after that, there's a really, I think, a kind of a profound thing. And it's, you know, Jonathan looks at David and it says, you know, "The soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul." The only one there at that time who could really even appreciate what he had just seen was Jonathan. At least that's kind of how it reads. And he knew it. He knew this is a man of God. This is somebody that God is working in, and he's a somebody. He essentially gives David his birthright by what he does, you know, which is kind of cool. And it goes on. He says, "Saul might selfishly seek to retain the valiant David about his person, not because of the love for his person, but simply to magnify himself. Not so Jonathan. He loved David. David had removed a load from his spirit and filled up a great blank in his heart. The challenge of the giant had, as it was each day repeated, developed the poverty of Israel. The eye might have ranged up and down the ranks in search of one able to meet the urgent need, but in vain. As the giant's vaunting words fell on their ears, all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. All, yes, all fled when they heard his words and saw his size. Terrible was the blank, therefore, left in the heart on this solemn occasion. And when a beloved one appeared to fill up that blank, what wonder that Jonathan's whole soul was drawn out in genuine affection for that one. And be it remembered that it was David himself and not his work only that touched Jonathan's heart. He admired his victory, surely, but his person more. It is well to note this and trace its striking application to the true David." I wouldn't know any of that if it wasn't for McIntosh. I mean, I see it, and after he says it, I see it. But I'm kind of killing two birds with one stone here. I do want to tell the story. This is something that affected me in my life, but I also, sort of a plug for McIntosh. I think if anybody hasn't read him, he's in the library. In fact, one of my first times being here, I think I got Bob, and I had him find him for me. I remember you took me over there, and we went through all the books, and you've got it all there, in case anybody wants to read any of it. So last thing I just want to say, and again, there's so much in David's life that I would love to. I could stand here and just read this book, because it just means that much to me, but I know it kind of doesn't mean that much to everybody, because we're all different, you know. So, but McIntosh says, "Faith imparts real dignity to the character and superiority over the petty circumstances of this transient scene. Those who know themselves as pilgrims and strangers will remember that the sorrows as well as the joys of this life are evanescent. They will not inordinately be affected, the believer will not be inordinately affected by either one or the other. Passing away is written on everything. The man of faith, therefore, looks upward and onward." I have read many things, and I still haven't come across anything as good as C.H. McIntosh. But, you know, God did a lot more in David's life than kill Goliath. You know, David went on to become a great king, and he there's other things about him that weren't so good. But He was an awesome character, and God loved him, and he loved God. And there was a passion there that, you know, as you read the book, you see that passion, and it's that relationship we have with God that we can all have that with God. You know, they say David is a type of Christ, but in a way, he's kind of an example. We're all a little bit of David. You know, we all make those same mistakes all the time. We're all going out bumping into walls. And God's grabbing us, and he's teaching us. And thankfully, we have his Holy Spirit to guide us as well. But that's why I think David's, you know, he's a really awesome character in the Bible. But he also goes on to write many of the Psalms. One Psalm in particular, I think, is kind of interesting. Psalm 27, verse 4. One thing I have asked of the Lord that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. So, you know, David, he's kind of asking for three things here. One is to dwell in the house of the Lord. The house of the Lord is really God's presence. He just wants to be with God, which I think pretty much every believer would share that desire. You know, you want to be one of his children. Once you see what that value, once you see what that's worth, you realize it's the most valuable thing there is on this planet. And fortunate we are to be able to say that. Second is to behold the beauty of the Lord, or the delightfulness of the Lord. To be so enraptured with God that all the fears and cares just kind of like get small. And God fills your heart. That hymn, the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. You know, I love that. And then the third thing is he wants to inquire or meditate in his temple. And that, I think, you know, there's another verse somewhere about the Spirit searching the depths of God. I think when you become a believer and you come to know the Lord, you do that. I think it's kind of automatic. So often you go through the day and you think, well, what's God doing here? What's he doing here? Why this? You know, how does this add up? And so I think the Holy Spirit kind of helps us with that one. But, you know, the question I have for you and for me as well is, how do we accomplish these three things? God's going to do it for us, but he wants us to act as well. This is a two-way street. So my way of doing this, I just think it's kind of simple, but I think God has given in me, and probably most other people, a desire to get to know the beautiful things of the world. You know, there's so much out there that he made, and he made it for us. It's not to drive past in your car as you're going to work. You know, those trees are beautiful things. They're all, everything out there is something that we deep down have a desire to get to know about, to get to love. And it's all God's creation. I don't see it as nature. I used to see it as nature. It's not nature. This is his creation. He makes everything. Every tree, every flower, every dolphin, everything out there, he made. And it's a wonderful thing. It's beautiful. And I think it kind of gives us some insight into God's character. You know, when you add it all up and you see everything that he's done. I think that beauty that's out there can really change your heart. I like to read books about explorers. You know, I grew up in the 60s when, you know, I can remember the Gemini years. I remember the Apollo years. I remember, you know, running home from school and wanting to see what's going on, you know. I remember a guy named Bergman who was the spokesman for NASA. He's like the one voice I remember, more than Cronkite. I knew when everything was going up. I knew every flight. My dad worked sort of in the space program. He worked for GE. So I kind of knew what was happening. And anyway, I kind of grew up having a taste for the explorers. And I've often read books about them. I read the whole Horatio Hornblower series. And you know, there's a lot of really good explorers, like the Arctic explorers, like Shackleton, Amundsen, John Ray actually mapped out the Northwest Passage. He was a Scottishman who, after he did it, he came home to England and he said something that they didn't like about, you know, the British not being prepared to do this work quite well. So they basically shut him up. So you don't hear his name anymore, literally, because he did that. But he's a great, great This is a guy who put a set of snowshoes on and walk 250 miles through the snow in a week and map out big tracts of the Northeast, the northern continent. But it's funny, like, these guys would go on these expeditions, and they go out for like 3 years at a time back then. You're talking about, you know, 120. Well, the first one, the Franklin expedition, was 1848. These guys would go out there, and they'd half freeze to death for 3 years. They'd starve. They'd get, you know, eaten by leopard seals. They'd come back after being out for sometimes more than 3 years. And, you know, when they were out there, they all kept diaries. Even the seamen would just keep diaries. And you'd go through these diaries, and you see these guys were just enraptured by the beauty that they saw. You know, just the ice has dozens of different shades of blue. It has its own whole spectrum of blue. And they would all describe this. And the night sky was like, you know, they would just go out and just be blown away every night. And the northern lights, you can imagine what these guys saw. And it so captivated them, and it did so much to them deep down. They would come home, be with their families, half of them frostbitten, they lost toes, they lost fingers. And the next chance they get, they want to go on another expedition, which I couldn't understand, but they were so captivated by that beauty that they saw down there. That's what it was. I think they were in touch with God down there in a very visceral way. When Shackleton was trying to get his last expedition, one of his last expeditions, they had to actually take these guys' clothes off so that they could see exactly how much damage they had from the frostbite before, because the guys wouldn't tell them. They didn't have any toes left. So that's the extent to which those men wanted to get back in touch with the beauty that they saw. Another little story is that I have a friend, Dan Noble. He's a Christian friend of mine, and he and I take time, you know, periodically we just say, okay, let's do it. We just blow up the schedule, we get in the car or the truck, and he has a kayak and I have a kayak. We either do land trips or ocean trips. We get down to Cape Henlope Inn or we go to the Delaware Bay. And we've been doing this for years and years and years. And it's a great time, and I love it. And if anybody ever wants to join us, you know, just get in touch with me. But his little girl got to where she was about 7 or 8 years old. And she'd see us going, and she always wanted to go with us. Well, finally she gets to the age where, you know, we can take her in a canoe. And so we took her to Prime Hook National Wildlife Refuge down in Delaware. And I don't know, you probably haven't been there. It's not a very popular place, but it's beautiful. It is like, it's like something out of Louisiana. There are bird species there that just don't belong up here, but it's just warm enough for them there. There's different kinds of heron. There's a place where you go around this bend and there are 75 white cranes that are this big nested in the trees, and they fly out over you and you're just blown away. And there's osprey and heron that will follow you the whole time you're there. It's about a 3-mile river that meanders through this kind of big wetland area. And you're in sight of one of them almost all the time. And there are otters, river otters, who are very territorial and will bump your boat. They don't like you being there. And they come, you see this little V-shaped pattern coming at you, and then you just hear the boomp, and then you see and there's fish jumping, and we actually encountered a beehive, which really scared her, because we had taken the course through this one little narrow opening, and the tree came down like this, and I went down, I was in front, and then you hear this buzzing, and it's like, bzzz, a lot of them, hundreds of bees around this thing. And the poor kid was scared to death, and rightly so. I was scared too, but. So we get through this day, we come back, get to the back to the van, and she was waiting for us to put the boat back on the truck. And I looked down, Dan or I looked down, and she was covered with bug bites. I mean, this poor kid had literally hundreds of bug bites, and she's starting to feel them now because we're not doing anything. And she starts scratching, and she's tearing up. She's really, we're thinking, you know, we have to get her to a pharmacy and get some Benadryl. But the poor kid must have been suffering. We're getting the boat up on the rack. We open the door to get her in, and she looks at her dad and she says, "You know, Dad, this was the best day of my entire life." I think getting her in touch with all that beauty was something again that hit her deep down, and I think that comes back to this, you know, to behold the beauty of the Lord. It's out there in a big way, you know. It's all around us. And you don't have to go to Colorado or Utah or, you know, France to see this stuff. Okay, I have a slideshow. Let's just go to the slideshow. I'm sorry, I didn't realize it got that late. Well, so I like to go out to different places, and another thing about me is I scan slides from my family. My father took many, many, many slides. So did my uncles, and it's a great picture into like Vermont and old world Americana, like World War II and up through maybe the 70s. I've got thousands of these things, but don't worry, I only kept like five. And I also I got pictures of places that I think might be cool for us to go to. I kind of skipped this part, but yeah, somewhere back there, I said I had that period where I didn't go to church, and I don't want to forget that I did stop in here one day, and I haven't stopped coming since. I think you people are really awesome. I see God working in so many hearts here in so many different ways, and I've just really been blown away, and I feel like this is where I belong. I belong here. I love it here. I don't know many of you like I would like to know you, but everybody that I've gotten to know has just been a total blessing to me. I love this chapel. I would like to do whatever I can to, in fact, I think that's what got me up here. A few months ago, I started praying that I would be more useful around here, and then I get this request to speak. Which you don't know. It was kind of tough for me. I don't like doing this kind of stuff. One time Ned asked me, we went on a trip to, I forget where it was, but he asked me to pray one night. We were out with the guys on the Appalachian Trail. I said, no, I can't do that. You know, I'm just not that way. But I saw this request. This was from God, and this is one you can't pass up. And I'm really glad I did it. And everybody's been really cool. I have gotten so much support, phone calls, emails. Just everybody's been so cool to me, and I really appreciate all your prayers and everything. But anyway, I'd like to just show a few slides here, I guess. Is there a pointer up here? Like a red thing? That guy in the middle there is my great-grandfather's brother. He was born just before the Civil War.
Top button.
Him. That's my great-uncle John. This is my older brother. He's now 66 years old. This is my older sister. These are aunts. That's my Aunt Mildred. I love these kind of pictures because you look in their faces and you see like what life has done. You know, I mean, they're happy, but they've been through a lot. And this is kind of a classic Vermont-type picture. That's my mother. This is in the 40s. That's an uncle. That's a cousin. This cousin now owns that farm. The farm still looks exactly like it did back then, believe it or not. It's kind of amazing. He's kept it pretty much the same. He's 76 years old now. This is my grandmother, Grammy. This is my mom. This is my aunt. Again, that's my older brother. Cousins here. This dog, you know, when I started scanning these slides, my mom was getting older. My father had passed away about 10 years ago. I would go over to the house just to kind of hang out with her because she didn't really have dementia, but she needed somebody around. She was in her late 80s and wasn't fully capable of functioning. So I just had to hang out and kind of looking for things to do. That's when I found the cigar boxes with all the slides in it. And then we found more and more cigar boxes. And it was a gold mine. So I bought this scanner, a Nikon Cool Scan, and just started scanning and scanning and scanning. And my mother would come up to the boys' bedroom where I had the scanner, and she would look at them, and she just loved it. It was so great to see her. And she'd look over my shoulder, but she didn't want to bother me, so she'd never sit down. But she'd stand there for like an hour. I'd say, Mom, have a seat. No, I'm going to bed. Well, who's that? You know, and it was wonderful. But this one here, I said, Mom, what's the dog's name? And she looked, she said, oh, that's Rover.
So, Mom, and she didn't really look at it. She was still looking over here. I said, Mom, you didn't really look. What? How do you know, the dog's name is Rover? She said, all the dogs are named Rover. They did that. And when the dog got old, you had old Rover, and then you had young Rover. That's my father and his 9-foot skis, and my brother on his back, and you see all the safety gear they had back then. That's my cousin Wes. That dirt road is still a dirt road. It's still there. It still looks like that, and the stream that he's going fishing in is still there and still looks very much like that. Now, he just had his 50th wedding anniversary last week. Yeah. That's the farm. That's where my mother was born, right there. This is the field that she used to go up. She used to have to go, well, probably like way over here, chase the cows over and down. And then they would milk them in there. That's where this apple tree is still here. So is this one here. We still get apples from it. I'm going to be making apple cider in a couple of weeks. No, maybe 6 weeks or so. And it still looks very much like that, although this barn fell down, and it kind of fell into the road. My cousin, they got a knock on the door about 3 o'clock in the morning, and the police were there, and they said, your barn's in the road. So, so they kind of had to get out there and scoop things up. But this barn is still here. In fact, I was up there in April working on... Well, we're just doing some work around the outside. It needs some help. It needs to be jacked up in the middle, and my cousins and I are trying to get that worked on. This is one of the things my dad loved us doing. And my mother hated the squirrels because they made a mess out of the dogwood tree. They would bite the things, and she was always sweeping. She would go out with a broom and chase them. But they knew she didn't have a gun or anything. So they'd get around her, and they'd get to us, and they knew we'd feed them. And we actually got to the point where they were almost like pets, you know. And here again, it's like, this is the kind of thing you just don't see people doing today, because this takes time. This took a lot of time for us to do this. We had the time, and we enjoyed it. But today, I think we're so into our tablets and our phone and our computer and the games. And I don't think we do this kind of stuff as much anymore. Not as Christians, but I think the world certainly has gone away from this kind of activity. I remember we had one, we found a little baby, and my dad had a big flannel shirt, and he would climb into my dad's pocket and just go to sleep. These things were awesome. We would open up the second story bedroom, the boys' bedroom, and there was a desk right by that window, and we actually had them that they would come in. We would put the peanuts on the desk, and they would come in the house. I know, it sounds like, you know, maybe not a good idea, but we loved it. And you know, the funny thing is my father liked it too. He was cool with it. So I was going to talk a lot more about trees. This is a pine tree, and these are pine cones, and those are buds. Next time. Forget it. This is way too time-consuming. I do have some that I want to show you, though. This is a bristlecone pine. Does anybody know why this tree is significant? What makes it different from all other trees? Ned?
About 5 or 6,000 years old.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the oldest living thing that we know of, that I know of. Not including the aspen, you know, whatever that is. But no, this, as being an individual tree, it's that old. It goes way back. I mean, when David was alive, that tree was alive. Here again, this is the Mariposa Grove. And I just think, again, it's just the awesomeness of God, you know. Who can make a thing like that? The imagination involved in... It's just so beautiful. I've been out, I've seen the redwoods, and I don't know, you just marvel at this kind of thing. I think those are Sitka spruces, and I was going to tie this into the talk about the trees, because you see how those trees are growing now. They know the wind, they don't have good soil, that's how they grow when they're in this environment, very, very narrow. These trees could be 300 years old. And that's all they grow. And the interesting thing is, if you take a tree like this down into this area around here, it will fill out. What amazes me is that trees don't have brains, but they take all the information that their environment is giving them, the wind velocity, the temperature, the depth of the soil, the rainfall, and they process it. And when it goes to that growth phase, they know what to do. even though there's no brain. Just God, you know? Just cool. I love, Carl Sagan did that thing, Cosmos, many, many years ago, decades ago. And I used to love that because he would often get to the point, you know, he was a scientist, he knew what he, but he would get to the point where he would just say, this is just awesome. He would just marvel at what the universe can do. And I don't know. I thought that was really cool about him. This, I put this in there for Karen. She made it. Okay, good. Karen and I share a love of mushrooms. I think they're another thing. It's like, you know, you go out in the woods, it's not just the trees. I mean, you'll go walking, it's like, wow, what is that thing? You know, and never seen it before, don't have a clue what it is. These at least I know what they are, but I think they're beautiful. There's the past, I haven't been out this year because I've been busy, but like for 2 or 3 years in a row there, we had these wet spring and summers, and the creations that were popping out of these dead trees, these beautiful, I have probably 1,000 pictures of mushrooms too. So does my brother. My brother really likes mushrooms as well. This tree, Edgar, do you recognize that tree? No? Hazel? It's 1 mile from your house. Okay, you've been driving by it. That's a tulip poplar at Tyler Arboretum. It's right on the road. That's my youngest nephew, that's Justin, that's my niece Amanda, who just got back from Iceland and has a great picture of three polar bears swimming towards their little campsite. She's again, I think the outdoor gene kind of went. So, but that poplar tree, I mean, just look at that thing. You know, that's half hour drive from here. So if anybody wants to know someplace where you can go and see some really cool stuff, I know a lot of them. I know Tyler like the back of my hand. And I'd love to take you there if anybody ever wants to go. It's a blast. That's not the only tree there that's really cool. They've got the biggest sequoia east of the Mississippi. They've got bald cypresses in there. They've got just all kinds of cool stuff. This place here is in Lower Delaware. That's called Trap Pond. And here you feel like you're in South Carolina, you know. Those are bald cypress. And bald cypress are deciduous conifers. They are cone-bearing. They look like pine trees, but yet they lose their needles in the fall. And these here, you know, they can live like this for long, long periods. And 9 months out of the year, they can take water all the way up to there. Sometimes if it's wet, they put up these cypress knees. I don't know if you've ever seen them. You might have seen them decorated with a face. And people used to cut them off and make decorations of them. But you'll see these things popping out of the ground, and it's the root system getting up to get the oxygen that it needs to survive. But this place is about a 2-hour drive from here, and if you can get into a boat, you can see some, it's just, you get lost in there, it's just beautiful. Sunfish Pond, this is, what, 90 minutes away, Ned?
Yeah.
And an awesome place. It's right on the border of New York and Pennsylvania. It's the Delaware Water Gap near there. Short hike from a parking area, wonderful hike, beautiful place. And it's the only glacially formed lake in the lower 48. These rocks are very strange and angular. I don't know if you can tell that, but all the rock formations are really strange. You just get this feeling like you're in a different kind of place when you're there. It really is a neat, just a cool place. This is one of my favorite places. It's called Welkenweir. And it's a 200-acre old estate that has been, over the past 20 years or so, kind of turned into a conservancy. Their mission, it's the Green Valleys Association. When you drive by these signs that say French Creek Watershed, you know, Green Valleys does all that kind of stuff. They're nice people. They're tree huggers. They're interesting folks. They love nature. They don't know that nature is creation so much, but they're nice folks. That's just one of the ponds. The guy that actually built it initially built like 5 big ponds, and that's the lower one looking up into the upper one. And here, that's Welkenweir as well. That's the bigger pond. I would love to take folks out there. In fact, I was thinking maybe to do that this afternoon, but obviously it's just not going to happen. Maybe someday we could get a group to go out. I'll be happy to walk you around. It's 200 acres and it's beautiful. It just goes on and on. There's tons of trails to take and all kinds of trees there that we can. And this here is only a few miles from John Lytle down in Lower Delaware. Bombay Hook National Wildlife Refuge, right on the Delaware Bay. Beautiful. A lot of tidal action. You can go out there, go picking for sea glass, just see all kinds of beauty. You know, again, you don't have to find things. It's just being there that it's the absence of man and all that structure is, I think, the goal. And that's one of my favorite places. I love going to Cape Henlopen. Is just a wonderful place. That's the point. That's the lighthouse there, the second one out. And it's a great place. If you get a kayak, you don't even have to get a kayak. You know, I could just stand on the beach and just hear the waves. It's mesmerizing. It's God's voice, you know, the crashing down. And this is, my friend Dan and I, one of the things we do when we go places is we have kites. Dan flies a Hata. It's an Indian kite. It's a fighter. They fight them. But I have a parafoil, and it's kind of fun. It's a four-string kite. You can take it. You can bring it right out over the water, and then right back over the dune, and you're right back over the water. It's fun. I could do it all day long. And you can keep it, if the wind is just right, you can keep it right off the waves. I mean, inches. And it's kind of cool, because you know how people are always going up and down the beach? Sometimes I'll look over, and there's all these people just stay right there, just watching. Because it's cool. You know, they want to see if I go in, too. If you go in, you got to go swimming for this thing. It's not easy to get out, because when it's soaked, it weighs 100 pounds. But it's worth it, though. It's a lot of fun. This is the Gully River. I once worked at a hospital that every year they would get together a trip and we would go down to West Virginia, the Gully River, the New River, well, the Upper Gully, the Lower Gully, and the New River. And a lot of rapids, a lot of really cool white water. I'd love to see us get a group to go there sometime. Just food for thought. And that's the Adirondacks. And Francis Schaeffer's books made it right over that. No, they're still in my attic. And this is the guys, Scott and his son, Ned, me, David, and Charles. We have done this. I'd love to see us do it more. I'd love to see the ladies get out too, and maybe we can do this together. So, and that's Harper's Ferry. I think you guys went down there last trip. I wasn't there, but I forget what river that is. There's three rivers that come in there, but just, again, a beautiful spot. So, anyway, I'll just kind of end it there. That's all I have. I'm gonna say a quick prayer, and then we can all sing a song. I've got a little hymn I'd like to. Heavenly Father, I just want to thank you so much for doing the work that you have in our lives. Thank you for, most of all, revealing yourself to us and the work that Jesus did on the cross to restore our relationship with you. Lord, we just thank you for being so awesome and so wonderful and so loving. And we thank you for your word. We thank you for the fact that we can get together here in fellowship and enjoy each other's company and learn about you. And that we have all eternity to continue to do this. What a blessing to us. In Jesus' name.